Harper. She can't get over the sense of exhilaration that fills her when she drives her Bronco off the ferry onto Nantucket. She hasn't been here in 14 years, but even so, everything is basically the same. Young's bicycle shop, the juice bar, steamboat pizza. But by far the best thing about Nantucket is that here, nobody knows her. There is no one to avoid, no one to be scared of. She drives to the house from memory, making a wrong turn only once before turning into the white shell driveway of 776 Cliff Road. It's as stunning as ever. There are 100-year-old trees and a verdant lawn, hydrangeas on the verge of exploding into bloom, neatly trimmed boxwood hedges, and window boxes on both houses. The window boxes have mandevilla trellised in the back going up in spires. Between the spires are bursts of whirling butterfly gara, thick silvery Provence lavender, and fairy roses. Fountains of Silver Falls dichondra and hot pink million bells spill out over the edges, and tucked into the crannies are dark leaves of ipomoea and sprays of diamond frost euphorbia. This is an extravagant combination, not unlike those at the estate Jude used to privately call the floral whorehouse, which she charged $750 per container to plant and maintain. Harper parks at the carriage house and, finding it unlocked, lets herself in. The house smells like evening in Paris, the scent Eleanor wore all through their childhood. Harper supposes that Tabitha must now wear it, because she is slowly but surely turning into Eleanor. The carriage house is upside down, three bedrooms and two baths on the entry floor, then stairs that lead up to the living space. Fish goes nuts with the cornucopia of new smells. He is in and out of every bedroom, his tail slamming against the door frames. Harper identifies Tabitha's room, all white bed, 50 million pillows in different sizes, and a bolster the size of a fallen tree. She probably still sleeps on top of the covers, because getting underneath them messes up the sheets, and somewhere within the logic of Tabitha's brain, it is better to have crisp, clean sheets than to enjoy sleeping in them. Whatever. Ainsley's room is the one that smells like pot and has a highball glass filled with, Harper takes a tiny sip, vodka on the dresser. Okay. Harper dumps the glass in the bathroom sink and throws her duffel bag in the third bedroom, which appears to be a catch-all. There's a bed with a full-size mattress and a coverlet that Harper remembers from the cottage on Prospect Street. It's white matelassé, yellowed now. There is a desk covered with shelter magazines, Domino, House Beautiful, Traditional Home, Architectural Digest. Someone is an interior designer wannabe. Ainsley? Tabitha? There's a Windsor chair at the desk, but aside from that, nothing else. Plenty of room for the dog bed. Upstairs is more formal, a gorgeous cherry dining table with six low-armed chairs around it and a tall bouquet of fresh delphiniums in the center. There's a turquoise tweed sofa with swanky 1960s curves, above which hangs a rectangular mirror. There is a TV on a glass and acrylic console and dressmaker's dummy in the corner wearing the Roxy in lime green, which initially gives Harper a fright. She thinks for an instant that it's Tabitha. The kitchen is beautifully outfitted and well-equipped, but it's too clean, never used clean. Shame, she thinks. What she could have done these last 14 years with a kitchen like this. Fish comes to bury his snout in her crotch, a sign that he approves. Well, good, Harper says, scratching his ears. Just don't get used to it. 6 days. 7 at the most. Harper finds the grocery store. It's a Stop and Shop, and Harper feels a pang of longing for Kronig's and the reliable market, which is really reliable only for being expensive. As Harper is climbing out of her Bronco, she feels a hand on her arm. Tabitha? Harper looks up to see a very handsome, clean-cut man in a shirt and tie and horn-rimmed glasses. He looks like Superman before he's Superman, He looks like Clark Kent. I'm not. Did you get a new car? Clark Kent asks. He gasps when he sees Fish asleep across the back. Did you get a dog? The look of utter shock on Clark Kent's face is enough to make Harper laugh. She nearly plays along. How many times in their early life did one twin pretend to be the other? A twister, they called it, short for twin sister. No one could tell them apart. No one. Harper nearly says, Yeah, I traded in for this old clunker. Can you believe it? What does Tabitha drive? Harper wonders. A red Mercedes convertible, as sleek as a woman's shoe. And I got a dog. I figured I needed one more pressing responsibility. But Harper can't do it to this guy. She grins. I'm not Tabitha. Tabitha, Clark Kent says. I know the other night was awkward, and I'm sorry. Harper is, naturally, dying to hear about Tabitha's awkward night, but she interrupts because to let him continue only to satisfy her wanton curiosity seems cruel. She's on Nantucket. It's a fresh start, and she's going to be nice. I'm Harper Frost, Tabitha's twin sister. Her. Clark Kent fish mouths as he searches for words. Her twin sister. I live on Martha's Vineyard. Clark Kent nods once. She told me about you. Well, that's something, Harper says. We haven't communicated much in the past decade and a half, but last week our father died. Clark Kent's eyes widen. And on Monday evening, our mother fell down and broke her hip. Here, Clark Kent gasps. Eleanor? Harper tilts her head. How do you know my sister? Clark Kent straightens up and offers Harper his hand. I'm being terribly rude. I'm sorry. My name is Ramsey Stryker. Well, I lived with your sister, Tabitha. I dated Tabitha for 4 years. Lived with her for 3. We broke up in February. Ah, Harper says. She studies the guy. Tall, successful looking, well dressed. Tabitha's type, or what Harper has always pictured as Tabitha's type. Although the only real boyfriend of Tabitha's that Harper has ever met is Wyatt, who was not Tabitha's type. Which is one reason, of many she supposes, that it didn't work out between them. Harper would like to pin Ramsey Stryker to a board like a butterfly specimen and ask him 10,000 questions. As if reading Harper's mind, Ramsey Stryker checks his watch. Do you want to go grab a drink? He asks. It's the lunch hour, and places will be crowded, Ramsey says, so he suggests the brewery because Harper can bring her dog. Brilliant, Harper thinks. Ramsey is thoughtful. And, as it turns out, the brewery, Cisco Brewers, the sign says, is the perfect laid-back place to go on a mild, sunny afternoon. Harper loves Nantucket already. The brewery features a large brick patio surrounded by rustic farm buildings. One building sells beer, another sells wine, and yet another sells spirits. Perched on a stool with a golden retriever at his feet, is a long-haired guy playing the guitar. There are a few dozen people sitting at picnic tables, drinking and eating guacamole and chips or oysters from the food trucks. Ramsey and Harper choose an empty picnic table, and Ramsey says, How does a beer and a lobster roll sound? Harper loves a man who instinctively knows what a particular moment calls for. Like heaven, she says. Harper limits herself to 2 beers and just a sip of the third, because she still has to go to the store and make it back to the carriage house before Ainsley gets home from school. She has told Ramsey about herself and Tabitha growing up, all the way to the divorce and the family divided between 2 islands. Ramsey says, So why the rift between you and Tabitha? Why the rift? So many reasons. Starting with that fateful game of rock, paper, scissors. Harper tries, for the 10,000th time, to imagine what would have happened if Tabitha had chosen scissors instead of rock. It would have been hellish to watch Tabitha roll away with Billy while Harper was trapped with Eleanor in the mausoleum on Pinckney Street. The furniture in that house was all 200 years old, heavy, dark, and ornate, with brocade upholstery and velvet drapes. The library was filled with dusty books, and oil portraits of their creepy, roxy ancestors hung on the walls. Would she have hated Tabitha? Yes, she supposes she would have. But she wouldn't have become Eleanor's disciple. That had been Tabitha's willful choice. Other things had happened to Tabitha that had been beyond her control. Julian. Harper is not going there. She realizes that information has only been flowing one way during this lunch. Ramsay hasn't divulged anything about his relationship with Tabitha, and they're running out of time. It's already 2 o'clock. How are you able to do this? Harper asks. This? Take a 2-hour brewery lunch? Oh. Ramsay laughs and nudges his glasses up his nose. My name is on the door. Family business on Main Street. Insurance. Why did my sister let you go? She asks. Wow, Ramsay says. Nice reversal. Thank you. Harper smiles at him. I don't know why I'm assuming it was she who broke up with you. It might have been you. No, it was Tabitha, Ramsay says. But he doesn't seem inclined to add anything more, and Harper takes the hint. She says, this has been really fun. Thank you for lunch, but I have to go, and I'm pretty sure Ainsley gets home from school between 3 and 3:30. She does, Ramsay says, assuming she's not staying for detention. Detention? Harper says. Is Ainsley a bad kid? She's a great kid, Ramsay says, but she's been given no boundaries, so she pretty much does whatever she wants. No boundaries? Harper says. None, Ramsay says. He holds up his palms in a gesture of surrender. It'll be good for her to have a different authority figure. I'm only staying 6 days, Harper says. 7 at the most. Give her all the love you can, Ramsay says. And some from me as well. Tell her I miss her. At 7 o'clock, Harper calls Ainsley to the table, and Ainsley approaches with wide eyes. Wow, she says. This is the first time we've ever used the table this way. What way? Harper asks. Like, for eating, Ainsley says. Harper tries not to let the surprise show on her face. Really? We go out, Ainsley says. Or we eat Thai food standing at the counter. Or cereal in front of the TV. Oh, Harper says. My mother is very busy, Ainsley says. Harper has lit the candles and filled the Waterford goblets with ice water. Cheers, she says. Ainsley lifts her glass. Her hand is trembling. Are you okay? Harper asks. Ainsley nods, but she doesn't meet Harper's eyes. Is she stoned? Harper wonders. Has she been throwing back vodka shots in her bedroom? Ainsley? This is pretty, Ainsley says, indicating the candles, the tablecloth and china, the silver, the wide, shallow bowls filled with pasta and salad, the basket of bread. Thank you. She seems on the verge of tears, and a lump presents in Harper's throat. But Harper sensed this, didn't she, at Billy's memorial reception? Ultimately, that's why Harper agreed to come. Tabitha treats Ainsley like another adult, which was how Eleanor treated both Tabitha and Harper. They were never allowed to cry or whine. They weren't cuddled or indulged. They weren't allowed to be children. They hadn't been mothered. Tabitha had rebelled the year she turned into a pony, and Harper, well, Harper had rebelled later, she supposes. And now Tabitha is doing the same thing with Ainsley. She doesn't cook for the girl, and Harper would bet she doesn't kiss her goodnight. She doesn't nurture, when even the toughest, most badass child requires a little nurturing. Harper fixes Ainsley a plate of food, then a plate for herself. Eat, she says. Eat. After Ainsley has cleared her plate, wiping up the last of the sauce with a piece of bread, she falls back in her chair. That was really yum. I'm glad you liked it, Harbor says. She rests her elbow on the table, chin in her hand. We were so busy eating that I neglected to ask about you. How's school? Do you have a boyfriend? Just like that, the tears start, and the story falls out. Had a boyfriend, Teddy, new kid this year from Oklahoma, everything fine until this party I threw here last weekend. He decided he doesn't want me, he wants Candace Beasley. Candace was my friend, then not my friend, then almost my friend again until she stole Teddy. Oh, honey, Harper says. She holds out a hand, and Ainsley takes it and squeezes. It's a story as old as time, Harper thinks. I love you, you love somebody else. For the first time since she got to Nantucket, she thinks of Sadie, Zimmer, and Drew, the people she has wronged. Then she thinks of Reed. He is an ether surrounding her. Harper's love for him is her atmosphere. She's always thinking of him, even when she's trying not to think of him.
But that's not the worst thing, Ainsley says.
She's all snotted up, so Harper rises to fetch some tissues. Her poor niece is suffering from teenage angst, trying to make sense of an unfair world. Oh, how Harper had hated growing up. No matter what she has gone through recently, it has been ameliorated by the adult knowledge that regardless of how bad things get, she will survive.
What is the worst thing? Harper asks.
She hands Ainsley a box of tissues and sits down, scooting her chair closer. Fish, sensing people anxiety, plops down at Harper's feet.
My best friend, Ainsley says. Her name is Emma.
There's a noise, a slamming door, a voice amped up with anger.
Ainsley?
Ainsley's eyes widen, and she leaps to her feet, knocking over her Waterford goblet, which snaps where the cup meets the stem, a clean decapitation. Harper inwardly curses. Tabitha will blame her for that, no doubt, but Ainsley doesn't even seem to notice.
Mom?
She says. Her voice contains what sounds like terror. Tabitha is clicking up the stairs. Harper can hear her stilettos on the hardwood. She wonders if the unthinkable has happened and Eleanor has died. But it quickly becomes apparent from the set of Tabitha's mouth and the smoke coming out of her ears that the problem isn't Eleanor. It's Harper.
What the hell are you doing here? Tabitha asks.
Tabitha. What bothers her most is how cozy they look. The Stephen Swift table is set with china, silver, and the Waterford goblets that were a wedding present to Eleanor and Billy. The candles are lit, dripping wax down the Georg Jensen candlesticks. Harper has cooked a meal. The air still smells of toasted bread, garlic, onions, bacon. Tabitha's stomach rumbles. At the hospital, it was coffee and crackers from the vending machine, and back at the hotel, it was wine and microwave popcorn. Two of the chairs are pulled close together. Tabitha imagines her daughter and her sister sharing confidences. Tabitha had preferred seeing the table used for beer pong.
I specifically told you that she wasn't allowed here, Ainsley, Tabitha says.
She? Harper says. Who is she? The cat's mother?
You,
Tabitha says. Ainsley asked me to come, Harper says. She assured me she had your blessing.
She lied, Tabitha says.
She turns her gaze on her daughter. Ainsley looks younger than she has in years. Her face is clean of makeup, her pale hair pulled back in a slack ponytail.
Again.
Hey now, Harper says. Take it easy.
Take it easy? Tabitha says. This is my house. Don't you dare tell me to take it easy. I'm sorry I lied, Ainsley says. I wanted Aunt Harper to come. I needed someone to watch me. I needed family.
Family? Tabitha says.
You abandoned me, Ainsley says. I'm 16 years old, not 18, not 25. You can't just leave me alone for days.
But look, Tabitha says, you lived.
Aunt Harper cooked for me. She bought groceries. She brewed iced tea because Coke Zero is poison.
It's not poison, Tabitha says. It is, though, Harper says. When Tabitha looks at Harper, she catches a glimpse of fur at her feet. She barely stifles a scream.
Is that your dog? Your dog is in my house?
The dog lifts its head, seemingly in response. Tabitha sees the intelligent face and the clear, cerulean eyes of a husky. This is Fish, Harper says. Fish, meet my sister, Pony. Fish studies Tabitha in a way that's unsettling, almost as if the dog is human. The dog turns to look at Harper, then back at Tabitha. He notices the resemblance, Tabitha thinks. She nearly smiles, but she stops herself. She doesn't want a dog in her house, even a beautiful dog like this one.
I want you out in the morning, Tabitha says to Harper. I told you never to come back here.
I thought we got past that, Harper says.
I was civil to you on the vineyard, Tabitha says. Civil, despite the fact that I got drenched and humiliated.
We have your poor decision-making to thank for that.
I can be civil to you for an afternoon, Harper, but that is a far cry from allowing you to live in my house and care for my child.
Are you back then? Ainsley asks.
Yes,
Tabitha says, but her cheeks burn with a lie. She only came back to grab her things and check on her daughter. She has a ferry reservation back to the mainland in the morning. Eleanor needs her. There is no one else. Tabitha called Eleanor's younger sister Flossie in Palm Beach, but was informed that Flossie was on a cruise in the Greek Islands. Tabitha will be in Boston through the weekend at least, maybe longer. She called Megan to see if she could come stay with Ainsley, but Megan, showing an unusual amount of backbone, said she would rather not. Tabitha called Wyatt again. No answer. And then she called and left a pleading message with Stephanie Beasley. Part of Tabitha considers just letting Harper stay. I met a friend of yours today, Harper says. We had lunch. Ramsey Stryker? Tabitha's mouth drops open.
You had lunch with Ramsey?
At the brewery, Harper says. He thinks it's a good idea that I stay with Ainsley. Ramsey thinks it's a good idea. You're a piss-poor parent, Tabitha. Against her will, Tabitha remembers the bouquet of wildflowers. She recalls skimming the cool water of the harbor with her toes. She remembers Harper's hot, boozy breath as she sang, I can't live with or without you.
Forget tomorrow, Tabitha says. I want you out tonight. Pack your bags.
Mom,
Ainsley says. It's okay, Harper says. She lifts the bowl of salad from the table.
Do not, Tabitha says. Do not touch my things. I want you to leave,
Ainsley says.
I wish Aunt Harper were my mother instead of you.
Ainsley, Harper says. Tabitha knows she is acting abominably. She wishes she had the capacity to forgive her sister and to celebrate her sister and daughter's forging of this new bond. But Tabitha can't get past 22 years of sour history. Harper has had it so easy living with Billy, or past what happened the night that Julian died. Tabitha's phone rings. It's Stephanie Beasley. Tabitha snaps back to the present moment. She feels a cool wave of relief. Stephanie will watch Ainsley. This is the solution Tabitha was hoping for.
Hello?
Tabitha says as she moves into the living room. Incredibly, the dog gets to his feet and trots after her.
Stephanie?
Tabitha? Stephanie says.
Your daughter.
What? Tabitha says. She sits on the sofa and, in spite of herself, reaches out to stroke the snowy white fur at Fish's throat.
Your daughter is a monster, Stephanie says.
Tabitha continues to rub Fish's coat, even as the ugly accusations spin out of Stephanie. Bottle of Bombay Sapphire and a baggie containing cocaine residue planted in Candace's locker. planted by Ainsley Cruz and Emma Marlowe. The girls were taking revenge because of what happened between Teddy and Candace.
I'm sorry?
Tabitha says.
It sounds to me like your daughter is trying to deflect the blame.
She may have gotten in over her head, Stephanie. Ainsley can't be the automatic scapegoat here.
Surely you see how unreasonable that is.
Unreasonable? Stephanie says. You've been away, and your daughter has been left without any adult supervision. I'm sure she waltzed right over to your mother's house and strolled out with the gin. Then she and her evil little friend planted it in Candace's locker.
Tabitha closes her eyes. If she goes over to Eleanor's house and checks the bar cart, will she find the Bombay Sapphire missing?
Of course she will.
She revisits what Stephanie said a few seconds ago. The girls were taking revenge because of what happened between Teddy and Candace. Teddy and Candace are together now, so soon after Tabitha found Ainsley and Teddy together in her bedroom?
Ouch.
Stephanie says, "You'll be hearing from Dr. Benz tomorrow."
Tabitha doesn't respond. She simply ends the call.
When she re-enters the kitchen, she sees that Ainsley and Harper are clearing the table. Tabitha watches the two of them moving in concert. It's like watching herself, the mother she always wanted to be, the mother she would have been if Julian had lived, with her beloved teenage daughter.
"Stay," Tabitha says.
Her voice is stern, and Fish, who has followed at Tabitha's heels, dutifully sits and gazes up at her. To Harper, Tabitha says,
"I have to go back to Boston in the morning. Eleanor needs me."
"Why don't I go take care of Eleanor?" Harper asks. "You stay here with Ainsley." Tabitha considers this. She recalls Eleanor weeping about Harper after Billy's memorial service. Eleanor, like Ainsley, is sick of Tabitha. But Tabitha didn't put in years and years with Eleanor in the business, only to be replaced by Harper at the end. There will be a payoff. Tabitha will inherit the empire. And even if that empire is diminished, Eleanor still owns a mighty fortune in real estate. The house here, the house on Pinckney Street. Tabitha will not relinquish her claim to that.
"Eleanor is my responsibility," Tabitha says. "We both know that."
"Don't sound so put upon," Harper says. "I've spent the last 10 months caring for Billy."
Tabitha scoffs. "Sleeping with his doctor."
"Caring for Billy," Harper says. "Feeding him, bathing him, driving him around, getting him to and from his doctor's appointments, making sure he wasn't smoking too many cigarettes or drinking JMO on the sly. And now I have to deal with selling Billy's house. And once I do that, you and I are splitting the proceeds, as per Billy's will."
This is news to Tabitha. Her wheels start to turn.
Proceeds sounds like unexpected income, the windfall she so desperately needs.
"Wait a minute," she says. "What's the deal with the house, exactly? How much are we talking about?"
"I had a broker come look at it. She said we can either renovate it or sell it as a teardown. I am not going to renovate. It'll cost too much and take too much time, and the contractors on the vineyard pride themselves on being unavailable. As a teardown, she says we can list it at $600 and settle for $500,000.
"Teardown?" Tabitha says. "Is it really that bad?"
"It's really that bad," Harper says, "which you would know if you had ever come to visit." Tabitha accepts that barb in silence. She clears her throat.
"Is there a mortgage?"
"Mortgage of $269," Harper says. 6% of the sales price goes to the realtor, and there will be other closing costs. If we do absolutely nothing to the house, we will each walk with $100,000.
$100,000.
Harper makes this sound like a king's ransom. And maybe to her it is. She couldn't be making more than $20 an hour at her delivery job. But for Tabitha, $100,000 won't even scratch the surface. Once she pays Ramsey back the $40,000 she owes him, that leaves $60,000, which will be eaten up by Ainsley's first year of college. Selling it as a teardown is Harper's preference because that's the quick, easy way out.
"How much if we renovate?" Tabitha asks.
"Moot point,"
Harper says, "We aren't renovating. Just tell me what she said, please." Harper sighs. She said she would list it at 1.1 if it's a quality job, but the place has to be gutted. And I'm sorry, but that is not happening. I don't have any savings. Billy has 90 grand in the bank, but probably less than that because I still have to pay the golf club for the blasted reception. Polly said a renovation would cost 150. That means I would have to go to the bank for a loan or borrow money from Mommy, and I am not doing that. Mother doesn't have it, Tabitha says. Even if she did, she wouldn't lend it to you for Billy's house. It doesn't matter, Harper says. We're selling it as a tear-down, pony. Tabitha lets use of the odious nickname slide because she's busy doing the math. If they sink 150 into Billy's house and sell it for a million, they would both walk with more than 300 grand. Ainsley says, Aunt Harper should stay here, and you should go to the vineyard, Mom. Haven't you always said it's your dream to renovate a house? Grammy's house, Tabitha says. She has long yearned to be given permission and an unlimited budget to redo Eleanor's house on Pinckney Street. But needless to say, neither has been granted. I said that about the house on Beacon Hill. Do Gramps' house instead, Ainsley says. You'd be good at it. Harper turns on Ainsley. No, we aren't renovating. Whose side are you on anyway? Ainsley frowns. I want you to stay, she says. Ainsley's suggestion is completely outrageous, yet something about it appeals. If Tabitha can reach Flossie or get Eleanor to pay out for a private nurse, she would be free to work on Billy's house, which is something she would profoundly enjoy. With Tabitha's eye and a little elbow grease, they'd make 3 times the money. How can Harper argue with that? While Tabitha is handling the renovation, Harper can stay here and deal with the fallout of Ainsley's behavior, and Harper can work at the boutique. The boutique is going to go belly up at the end of the summer. Tabitha has done everything within her power to resuscitate it, but to no avail. So why not let Harper take the blame for its demise? Is it too cruel to let Harper take over the sinking ship that is Tabitha's life? She remembers the sting of cold champagne in her face. Then the slap. The wildflowers, the chicken box, with or without you. Julian, dead. Once I get Mother settled, if I get Mother settled, I'll go over to the vineyard and take a look, Tabitha says. I'll handle the realtor and the sale, and you can stay here with Ainsley. But there are conditions. Such as? Harper says. Your first responsibility is my daughter, Tabitha says. I'm going to call the school secretary in the morning and let them know that you're in charge for the remainder of the school year. There are only a few days left, but if there are any issues, you'll get the call. Harper nods. Will there be any issues? Tabitha asks Ainsley. Ainsley looks at her feet. No. Ainsley? No, Ainsley says. Tabitha closes her eyes for an instant. She is so tired, so weary, that she could fall asleep standing up. You're a piss-poor parent, Tabitha. She wonders if her real motivation in agreeing to this plan is just an unwillingness to deal with Ainsley's bullshit. Maybe yes. And the feeling, apparently, is mutual. Ainsley's eyes are shining with hope. She wants her aunt. Be careful what you wish for, Tabitha thinks. Your second responsibility is the ERF boutique on Candle Street, Tabitha says. Megan is going to have her baby soon. She'll show you the ropes tomorrow, and both of you will have to put in a lot of work. I can do the buying remotely, but you'll be in charge of tracking the orders, getting them out on the floor, accounting for inventory, ringing up sales, and going to the bank each morning with the deposits. In addition to hand selling, of course. You'll have Mary Jo to help. She's blind, Ainsley says. Myopic, Tabitha says. I can handle it, Harper says. Yes, Tabitha says, and the part of her that has long wanted revenge on her sister is placated. There is no way her sister can handle it. I'm sure you can. Harper. Her alarm goes off at 6:30 the next morning, and Harper's feet hit the ground with a sense of purpose. Fish is already waiting by the bedroom door, wagging his tail. In the distance, Harper hears the wail of the ferry's foghorn. Tabitha is on that boat with her car. She is gone. Harper is in charge. "Take care of the daughter," Harper says to Fish. "Then mind the store." After Harper lets Fish out, she heads upstairs to find the coffee brewed and a handwritten set of instructions written out, along with an envelope containing $1,500 bills. Harper reads through the instructions, marveling at how Tabitha can be nearly 40 years old, yet her handwriting is still the same as it was when she was a 10-year-old girl and won the 4th grade penmanship award. "Harper," the note said, "please follow these basic instructions." Harper finds herself grateful for guidelines. She is both elated and terrified at the previous day's turn of events. She's going to spend the next few weeks, or longer, in Nantucket caring for her 16-year-old niece, which is something she knows exactly nothing about. 1. Ainsley, no drinking, no drugs. Infraction equals loss of phone for 1 week. No excuses. 2. Philippa comes on Wednesdays to clean. Philippa lives in the basement of Eleanor's house, and she will know if you are over there snooping. The words are capitalized and underlined, as if Harper's snooping were a given. Tabitha thinks Harper is a cheat, a liar, and a thief. Numbers 3 through 6 are about the store: the address, the security code, the numbers of the maintenance man, the landlord, Megan, Mary Jo, the police department, the fire department. 7. Dress yourself from present inventory. Pick 6 outfits, 1 must be the Roxy, and cycle through. Write down the exact items you take. 1 pair of shoes only. This store is a direct reflection of the Eleanor Roxy Frost brand. Don't mess this up. Harper gets an immediate case of the hot pricklies. She knows the Nantucket boutique carries brands other than Eleanor Roxy Frost, but these other brands will still be too fussy and feminine for Harper, and she is going to have to wear the blasted Roxy at least 1 day a week. She has a succession of nauseating memories: her confirmation at Church of the Advent, her 9th grade dance, her prom. Her adolescence was pockmarked with events for which she had to dress up. Tabitha had loved it. Tabitha had worn dresses and skirts voluntarily. Harper will worry about the store later. For now, she will focus on the daughter. She raps lightly on Ainsley's door. There is no answer. She knocks again a little louder, which elicits a groan. Harper cracks open the door. "Time to get up," Harper says.
"I'm sick," Ainsley says. "I have a migraine."
Harper nearly laughs. It's startling the way ailments, either real or perceived, pass down through the generations. For Eleanor, every headache was a migraine and required a cool, dark bedroom for 3 hours, followed by a double espresso and a double gin martini. "Get up," Harper says.
"Seriously, I get them," Ainsley says. "I can't move. My vision gets all splotchy and I feel nauseated. I'm staying home today."
"You're going to school today," Harper says. She snaps her fingers twice, and Fish leaps onto the bed and starts barking. Ainsley groans again and extends a foot to the floor. While Ainsley is getting showered, Harper makes her famous scrambled eggs, famous to her and Billy anyway. Harper uses double yolks, half and half, and a handful of shredded cheddar. She cooks the eggs slowly over low heat until they are deep golden and creamy. Harper makes a plate for Ainsley with a piece of lightly buttered rye toast, but Ainsley pushes the dish away.
"I don't eat breakfast."
"You do today," Harper says.
"I thought you were cool," Ainsley says.
Her voice has a ragged, snotty edge, and Harper wants to growl the way Fish does whenever Harper pulls out the grooming brush.
"I am cool," Harper says, "but if you think I'm going to let you do whatever you want this summer, you are sorely mistaken."
Mom let me do pretty much anything, Ainsley says. Well, no offense, but that strategy doesn't seem to be working, Harper says. I found the vodka in your bedroom yesterday, and I'm sure if I poke around, I'll find weed. Ainsley sneers. I'll save you the trouble. It's in my top drawer. Harper stares. Eat the eggs. Reluctantly, Ainsley takes a bite. She nods. They're good. What do they have? Like 10,000 calories per bite? Pretty much, Harper says, and the teenager grants her a smile. Rocky start, Harper thinks, but according to Billy's watch, she and Ainsley and Fish climb into the Bronco on time. Harper delivers Ainsley to the front door of the school before the bell. Have a good day, Harper says. Fat chance, Ainsley says. Do you want me to come pick you up? Harper asks. You're done at 2:30? I get a ride home with my friend Emma most days, Ainsley says. I'll text you if I need a ride. She climbs out of the car, tosses her hair, and strolls toward the front door. She is so pretty and so confident. How is this possible at 16? She is wearing skinny jeans, ballet flats, and a white cotton tunic embroidered with violets. Her hair is pulled off to the side in a messy braid, which adds a relaxed air to her very rigid posture. Her shoulders are set as if she's expecting an attack. It's only as Harper pulls away that she recalls their conversation at dinner. Ainsley's boyfriend, Teddy, has been stolen away by a friend of hers, but not Emma, someone else. Ainsley did mention Emma, but Harper can't remember in what context. Fish climbs up to the front seat, resuming his usual post as co-pilot. Well, the first days are the hardest days. Don't you worry anymore, Harper sings off-key. She reaches out to rub the back of Fish's neck, wondering how long it will be until she knows the ins and outs of Ainsley's personal dramas. At least she remembered that the boyfriend's name was Teddy. And now she knows that Emma gives Ainsley a ride home. Harper's phone rings in the console. She doesn't answer because she suspects it's Tabitha calling to make sure Harper got Ainsley to school on time. But when Harper gets back to the carriage house and checks her phone, she sees the missed call is from Rooster. Harper sighs. She had thought for a moment that she had successfully escaped her life on the vineyard. She lets Fish out of the car. Go, she says, but stay out of trouble. Fish trots off to check out the grassy terrain of Eleanor's front yard. Harper stays in the car, contemplating the phone in her lap. She pictures Rooster, so called because of his bright red hair styled up into a coxcomb, slumped over his desk, wearing his Ray-Ban Wayfarers inside because he is hungover. Why is Rooster calling? Maybe he wants her to come back to work. Maybe he has been unable to find anyone to replace her. It takes a very long time to learn all the little dirt roads in all the towns. It doesn't make any sense to hire a college kid, because by the time he or she finally figures out how to do the job effectively, the summer will be over. Also, a spotless driving record is required. Finding people with no speeding tickets, no accidents, and no DUIs is more difficult than one might imagine. Yes, Harper decides, Rooster is definitely calling to offer her her job back. He probably thinks she's desperate for it, but he would be wrong. Turning him down will be a gratifying way to start her day. She calls Rooster back. Harper, he says. He hits both syllables in a way that makes them sound like spikes. Harper has always liked her name for its waspy androgyny, but it's not soft or feminine. That name went to her sister. Wally, Harper says, trying to lighten things up. Rooster's real name is Wallace. What's up?
The rumors keep a-coming, Rooster says. I heard a real doozy yesterday. Are you sitting down?
She's still in the Bronco, still belted in, which seems appropriate. They can't hurt me, she thinks. All those vineyarders who are so bored with their own lives that they have to titillate themselves by parsing Harper Frost's questionable decisions. I don't want to know, Harper says. She means it. How will it help to know what people are saying? When the news broke about Harper's association with Joey Bowen, she had tirelessly tracked who had said what to whom. She had written it all down on a piece of poster board and drew lines to connect people until the thing looked like a spider web. Harper had then set out to do damage control, calling all the principal rumor spreaders to explain her side of the story, which had led to secondary and tertiary rumors that fanned the fires of people's interest and kept the gossip alive. It was a miracle Harper hadn't ended up in jail with Joey Bowen. From the distance of 3 years, Harper can see that what she should have done when the news broke was nothing. She should have let people talk, then lose interest. It had been a one-time incident. What she'd done had been wrong, really, really wrong from Jude's perspective, but Harper had been a very small cog in a far-reaching, well-oiled drug-selling machine. She had merely been guilty of delivering a package. It had ended up being 3 pounds of cocaine, but for all Harper knew, it was 3 pounds of potato salad.
"Just listen," Rooster says. "I think you'll get a kick out of it."
"I won't get a kick out of it," Harper says. "It's my life, Rooster."
"Everyone knows you were having an affair with Dr. Zimmer," Rooster says. "That was last week's news. This week's news is that you're also sleeping with a messed up surfer on Chappie."
Harper groans. "Brendan Donegal? He's a friend of mine, Rooster. I'm still allowed to have friends, right?"
"I'm your friend," Rooster says. "That's why I'm telling you this."
"You're not my friend, Rooster. You're my boss."
"And you're not my boss. You're my ex-boss." "Then guess what I heard? I heard that Sadie Zimmer left Dr. Zimmer."
Harper bites her tongue. Sadie left? This is something Harper hasn't considered. Instead of Reed leaving Sadie, Sadie might leave Reed.
"But then I heard she didn't leave. He left. Dr. Zimmer took a leave of absence from the hospital."
"A leave of absence from the hospital?" Harper thinks. She closes her eyes.
"Then I heard that you were gone and nobody knew where you went and no one knew where Dr. Zimmer went. So people are thinking the two of you are on the lam somewhere, like in Natural Born Killers, except not murdering anyone. Or maybe you are leaving bodies in your wake. Nothing would surprise me at this point, Harper, because the stories keep piling up like cars in a highway crash. So anyway, I'm glad you answered your phone. I have your final paycheck. Where would you like me to send it?"
She says nothing. There's no doubt in her mind that Reed's leave of absence was forced upon him by Adam Greenfield. There's no way Reed would ever abandon his patients of his own volition. But he left the vineyard? Where is he? Is he out in America looking for her?
"Harper," Rooster says.
"I'm here," Harper says.
"Where's here?" Rooster says. "Where do you want me to send your check?"
She hates that people are now talking about her and Brendan. She shudders at the thought of Mrs. Donegal somehow hearing the rumor.
"Harper?" Rooster says.
She doesn't want to tell Rooster where she is. The check is for $632 or thereabouts. Too much to ignore, but she doesn't want anyone to know she's on Nantucket. She doesn't want Sadie finding out, or Drew, or Drew's aunties, or anyone else. Nantucket is, in so many ways, the perfect place to hide right in plain sight.
"Send it to my P.O. box," Harper says. "Number 1888, Vineyard Haven." "So you're here then?" Rooster asks. "You're on island?"
Before she can confirm or deny, there's a beeping noise. It's her call waiting. The number is unfamiliar, but underneath the number it says, "Nantucket, M.A." Harper disconnects Rooster without explanation, without goodbye. Let him think she's in a place with poor reception, the Andes Mountains, the Yukon. It's the only way.
"Hello," Harper says. "Ms. Frost," a man's voice says. "This is Dr. Bentz. I'm the principal at Nantucket High School. I'm going to need you to come in right away."
Ainsley. Ms. Kerr doesn't contact the classroom over the intercom. Instead, she and Dr. Benz show up at the door of Ainsley's American history class in person.
Ainsley, Ms. Kerr says, come with us, please.
A murmur goes through the classroom, and Dr. Benz offers a game show host smile.
Don't let us interrupt your learning about Prohibition, he says. It was put in place for a reason.
Ainsley grabs her bag and slips past Dr. Benz into the hallway. Gathered in Dr. Benz's office are Emma and her father, Dutch, Candace, Stephanie, and Stu Beasley, and Tabitha. No, not Tabitha, Aunt Harper. Ainsley burps and tastes the eggs Harper made her for breakfast. She tries to catch Emma's eye. They are close enough as friends to be able to agree upon a strategy without speaking. But Emma's face is cast down at the table. Dutch looks pissed. His shaved head is ruddy with aggravation, and his tattooed arms are locked across his chest. Candace looks wounded, her parents solemn. Only Aunt Harper appears sanguine. When she sees Ainsley, she offers a shrug. She has no idea why they are here, and a consoling smile. The smile brings tears to Ainsley's eyes. Dr. Benz takes the last seat at the table. He seems present and engaged, but studiously unperturbed. He loves conflict resolution, Ainsley knows. A poster of Jimmy Carter hangs in his office. Emma, Ainsley, Dr. Benz says, we invited you here with your parents and or guardian today to see what either of you knows about a bottle of Bombay Sapphire gin and a baggie containing cocaine residue left in Candace Beasley's locker. Ainsley says, I know nothing about it. I mean, I heard Candace was caught with alcohol and drugs in her locker, but that's it. Dr. Benz studies Ainsley as though he intends to paint her portrait from memory. You're sure about that, Ainsley? Ainsley scrutinizes Dr. Benz right back. He has an oversized head, a walrus mustache, and glasses that make his eyes appear large and gelatinous. Dr. Benz is so thoroughly a principal that Ainsley has a hard time imagining him outside the school. She knows that he lives ensconced in a home owned by his wife's parents, and that in the summer, when his in-laws are in residence, he goes salmon fishing on the Copper River in Alaska. Ainsley feels sorry for Dr. Benz because he doesn't get to enjoy Nantucket summers. He must like his job a lot, because why else would he accept such a raw deal? Before Ainsley can respond with a calm, metered, yes, I'm very sure, Ainsley has spent the last year making lies sound like a truth. Emma speaks up. It was all Ainsley's idea, Emma says. Candace stole Teddy away from her, and Ainsley wanted revenge. Shrug from Emma. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. That's a direct quote from William Shakespeare. Dr. Benz clears his throat. Actually, it's the other William, William Congreve. And the quotation, Miss Marlowe, is, heaven has no rage like love to hatred turned, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned. Emma gives Dr. Benz an indulgent smile, though Ainsley knows she would like to tell him to go pound. Same difference, she says. Then she pauses for effect. Back to my story. Ainsley stole the gin from her grandmother's house, and the cocaine packet she got from Philippa's boyfriend. Philippa is the housekeeper from Mexico. Then Ainsley begged me to sneak both things into Candace's locker. Ainsley feels a zing, like she's been hit in the face at close range by a rubber band. What? Dr. Benz silences Ainsley with a hand. And how, Emma, did you gain access to Candace's locker? She gave me the combination a few weeks ago, Emma says. I forgot my chemistry textbook at home, and Candace lent me hers as a favor so that I could finish that day's assignments. I wrote down the combination. Dr. Benz turns to Candace. Is this true? You gave Miss Marlowe your combination? Candace nods, and Ainsley is so incensed. Emma and Candace are in cahoots that she blurts out, No, Emma, you stole the combination of everyone's locker from the office during a fire drill in the fall. I gave Emma my combination, Candace says in confirmation. Ainsley is silenced. She feels her aunt's hand on her back. Harper leans in.
Just tell the truth,
Harper whispers.
It's okay, whatever it is.
I stole the gin from my grandmother's house, Ainsley says, but it was Emma's idea, not mine, to plant it in Candace's locker. Emma stole the locker combination of every student in the school from this office in November. She's the one who brought in the cocaine packet. My housekeeper doesn't have a boyfriend. Emma took the cocaine from her father's jeans.
At this, Dutch Marlowe stands up and roars, "Watch who you're accusing, young lady!" Everyone at the table, including Dr. Bence and Stu Beasley, recoils. In these peace talks, Dutch is the renegade nation.
Watch how you speak to Ainsley,
Aunt Harper says. Now she too is on her feet. Your defensiveness tells me that you're probably guilty, and your demeanor is consistent with someone who abuses cocaine.
Shut up, Tabitha, you stuck-up bitch, Dutch says. Why don't you have your mommy call her lawyer?
Now, now, Mr. Marlowe, Dr. Bence says. There will be no name-calling.
It was Ainsley's idea, pure and simple, Emma says. I was wrong to agree to such a cruel plan, but Ainsley and I have been friends a long time.
Here, Emma starts to cry, and Ainsley's eyes grow wide at the sight. In the 5 years that they've been hanging out together, Emma has never grown weepy, much less shed a tear. Not even when discussing her mother, who moved to Florida when Emma was in kindergarten and never returned.
And so I just went along with it, even though I knew it was wrong.
It was your idea, Ainsley says. You pulled that cocaine packet out of your front jeans pocket yesterday before school.
I've heard enough, Dutch says. He glares at Harper.
You tell your daughter to stop accusing people of things they didn't do.
Dr. Bence touches the knot of his tie.
What we have established thus far is that neither the alcohol nor the packet with a cocaine residue in it belong to Miss Beasley.
Correct.
Stephanie Beasley says. Her hair is in a loose bun, and she's wearing a gauzy sundress, looking pretty and natural and every bit like half of the kindest, most solid parental unit in all the world. Stephanie gives Ainsley a pained look.
I don't know what Candace ever did to you, but you spent years making her life miserable, culminating in this regrettable stunt. The astonishing thing to me is that you thought you could get away with it. Because you've never been held accountable for any of the atrocious things you've done or said to people. And that,
here she looks at Harper,
is your fault, Tabitha.
I'm not, Harper says, but then, apparently thinking better of it, shuts her mouth.
This is my aunt, Ainsley says, not my mother.
Everyone at the table stares at Ainsley as if she has two heads.
This letter, left at the nurse's office, Dr. Bence says, pulling it out and setting it in front of Ainsley. You wrote this? Saying that you'd heard Candace Beasley had alcohol and drugs in her locker?
Ainsley looks at the typed paper. She had misspelled alcohol, A-L-C-O-H-A-L, on purpose to make it seem like someone less intelligent than she wrote it. Her grades aren't stellar, but at least she can spell. She doesn't know if she should admit to the letter. Can they check it for fingerprints or check the ink type against her computer at home?
Yes, she says.
Dutch checks his watch.
Can we go? He says. I have a restaurant to run.
Yes, Dr. Bence says. Everyone may go except for Ainsley and her guardian. I'll handle things from here. Thank you for coming. It's worse than the Salem witch trials, Ainsley thinks. Worse than Galileo or Joan of Arc. She, Ainsley Cruz, has been framed. She is so flustered at the failure of Dr. Bence to see past Emma's bullshit and Dutch's intimidation tactics that she can't find the words to speak in her own defense.
I'm giving you a 3-day suspension, Dr. Bence tells Ainsley. However, you will serve it in school and you will take your exams. That's a kindness from me. I'm well within my rights to assign you an out-of-school suspension and let you take zeros. Do you understand?
Ainsley opens her mouth to speak. It was Emma's idea, not mine.
The baggie of cocaine was Emma's contribution. She encouraged me to steal the gin. She said this was the only way to teach Candace a lesson, not only for stealing Teddy, but also for trying to be popular like us. Emma stole the locker combinations right out of Ms. Kerr's filing cabinets during a fire drill. But it won't do any good, because Ainsley started out with a lie. She lost all credibility, and there's no getting it back. She nods. Aunt Harper's hand is still on her back, steadying her. I'm very sorry about this, Harper says.
It's Ainsley who should be sorry, Dr. Bentz says. While serving your suspension, I expect a written apology to Candace and her parents, and one to Emma as well, for leading her down a wayward path.
Ainsley swallows. Okay, she says. She has to start serving her suspension immediately. She is taken to a room in the interior of the school that she didn't even know existed. She is being chaperoned by a teacher named Ms. Broody, whose sex had remained a mystery for most of 10th grade. Ms. indicated female, but her appearance, crew cut, men's polo shirts, flat front khakis, said otherwise. Understanding of her job at the school had also been hazy. Now Ainsley understands that Ms. Broody deals with discipline problems, serious discipline problems, one-on-one. Ms. Broody takes Ainsley's phone and hands her a stack of loose-leaf paper. Apology letters, she says. Her voice is surprisingly delicate and feminine. Then you may study.
What about lunch? Ainsley asks. What about the bathroom?
You'll have a chance to get your lunch and eat it here, Ms. Broody says. You get 1 5-minute bathroom break. The suspension room has no windows except for one in the door the size of an airport paperback. There is a desk and a chair. The walls are cinder block painted institutional beige. It's jail, and no sooner does Ms. Broody shut the door, she will be sitting right outside, than Ainsley starts to cry. The loose-leaf paper on the table in front of her catches tears dingy with mascara, like so many sooty raindrops. When she is allowed to go to the cafeteria, only long enough to stand in line and get her food, with Ms. Broody as an escort, Ainsley declines. She can't bear the idea of what people will say to her or about her. By now, news of her reversal of fortune will be everywhere. It's possible, likely even, that her friends have defended her and possibly even spoken to teachers and the administration in protest. It won't do any good, but it makes Ainsley feel a little better when she imagines it. The bathroom, however, can't be avoided. Ainsley waits until the last possible minute, but then she has to go. She stands and taps on the door. There isn't a clock in the room, so Ainsley has no idea what time it is. All she knows is that it is after lunch. Ms. Broody sets down her book. She's reading Dostoevsky, which must be a joke or a prop, and writes Ainsley a pass for the bathroom.
You have 5 minutes before I come hunting you down, Ms. Broody says. Use the bathroom outside room 107. It's the closest.
She won't lie. When she is in the hallway alone, Ainsley feels like running away. Out the door of the school, all the way home, never to return. She will be a 10th grade high school dropout. She wends her way out of the dimly lit corridors to the main part of the school and finds a clock. It's only 12:50. There's still an hour and a half to go. Ainsley hurries to the girls' room across from room 107. Then she realizes that room 107 is her chem class. She looks in the open door of the classroom, they're in lab, and catches Emma's eye. Ainsley doesn't know what she expects. An apology? Some sign of contrition or desperation? Maybe Dutch forced Emma to say what she did. Maybe he threatened to send her to a convent or even hurt her. But what Emma does is unexpected. She gives Ainsley the finger. Tabitha. Eleanor is a demanding and finicky patient. After she is released from the hospital, she and Tabitha repair to the townhouse on Pinckney Street, a place Tabitha had adored growing up, but that now feels stale and glum. The house has a layer of dust throughout. There is a lavish bouquet in the niche in the entryway, a weekly delivery from Winston's for as long as Tabitha can remember, that has died and browned to a crisp.
Mother, Tabitha says, we need to bring Philippa up here with us. I won't be your nurse and your maid.
Eleanor sniffs.
Or we can hire someone new, Tabitha says.
Heavens no, Eleanor says. I can't have a complete stranger seeing me like this. This is also Eleanor's excuse for not hiring a nurse.
I'll call Philippa, Tabitha says. She'll be here tomorrow.
Eleanor has an actual bell, an antique she inherited from her great-grandmother, who was a member of Boston society and a friend of Isabella Stewart Gardner, that she rings when she wants Tabitha to adjust her pillows or find Law and Order on the TV. Eleanor loves Law and Order, which is convenient, as the show pretty much plays 24 hours a day. Tabitha brings Eleanor fresh ice water, portions out her pain meds, and makes 3 trips a day to the Paramount on Charles Street, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Tabitha would complain about this, but it gives her a chance to get outside. It's June, and the city is experiencing the most beautiful days of the year. The common is lush and leafy. New mothers are out with their baby carriages, and there are skateboarders and bikers and joggers with their sinewy muscles. College girls in Ray-Bans and ponytails bob along, talking on their phones. Like. Carefree. When Tabitha goes to fetch lunch for Eleanor, she ambles through the Boston Public Garden. She can always blame the delay on the Paramount's perpetual line. The garden is in full bloom. Iris, peonies, roses. The pond is clear and clean, and the swan boats paddle along with barely a ripple. Tabitha's childhood here had been storybook in many ways. Eleanor had taken Tabitha and Harper to the Boston Ballet to see the Nutcracker, to the Museum of Fine Arts to see the Renoir exhibition, and Billy had season tickets at Fenway. As a family, they had a regular table at Marlyov on Friday nights because Eleanor loved the Welsh rabbit. They brunched on Sundays at Harvest in Cambridge. Tabitha first got drunk at a party in Gray's Hall after the head of the Charles Regatta her sophomore year in high school, and late that night puked at the feet of the John Harvard statue. Her Boston pedigree is impeccable in its details, but after so many years on Nantucket, she now feels like a visitor, and, under present circumstances, a captive. But she has no choice. She must care for Eleanor. When Harper calls with the news of Ainsley's suspension, however, Tabitha announces she's returning home. Please don't, Harper says. It won't change anything. Ainsley is experiencing some pretty wicked backlash from her friends at school, and unfortunately, this is my area of expertise, being ostracized. Tabitha is ashamed at how relieved she feels at being let off the hook. She is livid at Ainsley. She hates thinking that her daughter is capable of an act so stupid and cruel. But neither can she bear to think of Ainsley suffering at the hands of the other kids. She sends Ainsley a text. Tabitha, you okay? Ainsley, what do you care? Tabitha, I'm still your mother. Ainsley, so? Tabitha, so I love you. Ainsley, whatever, Tabitha. Tabitha reads this exchange over again and again until tears blur her eyes. She wants to go back to Nantucket and shake her daughter, or hug her. But she tells herself that the way to be the best parent right now is to stay away. If Tabitha were to walk in the house and take back the reins, Ainsley would do something even more destructive than she's already done. Tabitha is sure of it. Deliverance shortly arrives in the person of Tabitha's aunt Flossie, Eleanor's sister, from Palm Beach. Flossie is a firecracker. She's 8 years younger than Eleanor, but she looks and acts like she's Tabitha's age. She is a self-declared trophy wife, married to an 85-year-old descendant of Henry Flagler. She plays tennis, She shops, she lunches, and in the winters, she works 3 days a week at the Eleanor Roxy Frost Boutique on Worth Avenue. When Flossie arrives at the townhouse on Pinckney Street, she apologizes for not coming sooner. "I was on a cruise when you called, and then when I got home, I still didn't want to come. Boston is depressing, and my sister is a bitch on her best day. But then I thought about you. No one should be subjected to Eleanor like this. You've done enough, Pony." She makes a shooing motion with her hand. "I hereby set you free." Tabitha goes up to her room to pack her things to go home, but then she remembers that she and Harper have a deal. The thought is not unappealing. She will go to the vineyard.